Today's sponsor is The Monkey, you might have heard of it, from Neon and Atomic Monster. Based on Stephen King's iconic short story, The Monkey has been brought to the screen by Osgood Perkins, the writer-director of Long Legs, and horror master James Wan, who just so happens to be today's guest. Stephen King himself described The Monkey as, quote, batshit insane, and said, you've never seen anything like it. And Bloody Disgusting calls it the most outrageous horror movie of the year. I've seen it, and King isn't being hyperbolic here. The movie is bonkers as all hell and one of the most fun King adaptations to date. The Monkey opens in theaters everywhere February 21st. And that means it's time for the Fangoria House Read. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KINKCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping, astronomical, massive 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINKCAST. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. We've got a good one for you today. Our guest is a writer, director, and producer who has shaped and reshaped the horror genre multiple times since he hit the scene with Saw back in the day, and he continues to be one of the key figures in the world of cinematic horror. He helped rescue us from a glut of never-ending found footage movies and brought back supernatural horror in a big way with the Insidious and Conjuring franchises. He directed a billion-dollar superhero movie, introduced us to the unforgettable Gabriel in Malignant, and even made a Fast and the Furious flick. He has also worked on his fair share of Stephen King adaptations, which is kind of why he's here, including the upcoming Osgood Perkins movie, The Monkey, in theaters February 21st. It's about damn time he's on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome James Wan to the KingCast.
Welcome, James.
Hey. Nice to meet you guys. Oh, nice to see you guys again. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I am so psyched you're here. I know that back when Wampler and I started the show, like you were like at the top of our list. We got to get James Wan on because I think you at the time, like one of the early movies that was in the works or announced to be in the works, one of the adaptations that was still in the, that was percolating when we started the show was Tommyknockers. And I know that you'd worked on Tommyknockers for a while. And I think you worked with a friend of mine. I think you worked with Jeremy Slater on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's a tough nut to crack, that story. So, you know, I won't hold your feet to the fire there and force you to tell me all the stories of trying to develop that one. But but we knew like really early on that you were interested in King stuff and bringing King to the screen. And we're like, oh, we got to get you on. So I'm so glad that you're finally here. You know, this is, again, like I said in the intro, it's been a long time coming.
Definitely.
James, your name is now synonymous with cinematic horror. Just like Stephen King, you say Stephen King and people think scary right away, but you've done a lot of other things too. And clearly your interests are very broad, but you know, one of the things we always do is talk about origin stories, the King origin story. So if I may, Eric, can I ask James, what's your King origin story?
What is my King related origin story? Oh my goodness. You know, I think I obviously, like a lot of us, we probably were introduced to King's work probably through his movies more than anything. At least it was for me. You know, like I was introduced to his stories and I'm like, who is this Stephen King guy who's attached to all these crazy, outrageous horror films? And then as you get older, you find out, oh, he's a writer. And so then you start digging into his books and then you realize how incredible this guy is and how prolific he was, especially back then and God, even now, right? So, So I definitely was introduced to his stuff, his ideas, his stories early on through movies, and then hitting my teenage years, I started looking into his books, his stories, his short stories even. I think my very first short story of his, my very first book of his that I read was his short story for The Mist. And and at that point, I'm trying to think if I was really into Lovecraft yet or not, or maybe in a roundabout way, The Mist did introduce me to Lovecraft. Because that was Stephen King, doing his Lovecraft version of that world, and I loved it. I fell in love with it, and I started, reading up on it, and saw who he was inspired by, and then I started kind of branching out and discovering HP in the process.
I mean,
So that
that's
was basically my introduction to
nice.
Stephen King's writing.
The Mist was the first story in this book, Skeleton Crew,
Skeleton
which
Crew,
of
yes,
course
has
has
the monkey
the
in
monkey as
it.
its cover model and contains the monkey. That's interesting that that was your first connection to his writing.
Yeah, it's more his short stories. I think his bigger stories were so inundating, that was so overwhelming. And when you're a kid, with sort of short attention span and a bit ADD, you're like, oh, those may kind of take me a while to get into it, but I'll start with these ones. These seems more manageable. They're almost like the gateway drugs to Stephen King work in
Oh,
some
totally.
ways.
Yeah, I've been asked ever since starting the show. I've been asked a lot about like what's a good way if you want to start reading Stephen King and the, you can't start with The Dark Tower. You can't start with the magnum opus. You can't. It's hard to get somebody to read like I love It and I love The Stand, but it's hard to get somebody to read a
Oh yeah.
1,000-page book, right?
Right.
But if you go, if you really want to get a little taster, it's a sampler set. It's like getting a sampler at a restaurant, right? You read some of his short stories, and he's so good at short fiction. And
Yes. Yeah.
if you go to something like Skeleton Crew or Night Shift or even Nightmares and Dreamscapes or his more recent book, You Like It Darker, is another prime example of this. There's a variety of stories there. So it's kind of like I remember when I went to Hawaii the first time, somebody said, if you don't like the weather in Hawaii, wait 5 minutes, it'll change. And that's kind of the same thing with the short stories. If one isn't talking to you, yeah, don't worry, finish it out and you got a whole brand new next one that'll. Might be a sci-fi one, or it might be, darkly comic. You don't know. So it's a nice problem.
That's a great way to look at it. His short stories are basically appetizers. It introduces you to his style, his writing, his world, and if you love it, then get ready for his magnum opus, right? And he's got many big ones, big great ones. So I would say, I'm trying to think back, which was his, either his TV stuff or his feature films that really spoke to me very early on. I would probably say it was maybe It. It definitely was a big one for me. I'm a huge fan of just creepy clowns.
Well, clearly, man. I've seen your movies, even
You see my
when you're just
stuff,
kind of,
yeah.
I mean, Billy the Puppet isn't all that far removed from a creepy clown. So,
No, exactly. I mean, yeah, Billy is basically a creepy clown, ventriloquist puppet. So yeah, so I'm definitely attracted to the more ghoulish nature of his stories, because those are the ones that really speaks to me, and they're just great. And so that's coming to the monkey. That's another reason why, us, my company, Atomic Monster, were really sort of latched to it early on. We're really in love with it early on. Is from the get-go, who is the star of this story, right? You see the poster, what the poster is gonna be, and for me, those are the ones that translate the best into a cinematic medium, right? Because straight away, this is high concept. I can sell it. I can build a movie around this particular idea, and then you don't have to spend 20 years trying to explain to the studio how to market the movie, because they can see it as well. And so that's my business brain, working there, going, okay, when I pick a movie, I need to make sure that movie, the studio understand what they're making and ultimately know how to market it. And I think, generally speaking, most of Stephen King stuff are very marketable.
Yeah.
That's
Well,
what
he
it's
has
called.
that iconic imagery, right? The car of Christine, that
Right.
cherry red Plymouth Fury. He has the cat from Pet Sematary, he has the clown from It. Like he always
Right.
has something visual that you can
Yes.
graft onto
Yeah, no,
emotionally.
totally. Yeah, that's really true. And I think because I'm such a visual artist or filmmaker that having an author, or having a writer who really appreciates the sort of the visual iconographic nature of his characters in his world is very important. Like it's important for me to kind of latch onto that and be able to see what I can do to bring that to life. Whether it's to bring Pennywise to life or bring the monkey to life or all that kind of stuff. And you can see why the ones that do break out big are the ones that have these elements that the filmmakers can latch onto.
Well, and we've had Steve, and I almost called him Steve King. It feels so pretentious when I do that. That's what he wants to be called when you talk to him, and you kind of fall
Right.
into it. But I mean, the
Yeah.
man's Stephen King.
He's Mr.
We've had him
King.
on the show
Uncle,
a
let's
couple
call him
times.
Uncle Steve. Uncle
Uncle Steve.
Steve.
I like
Okay.
Uncle Steve. That's cool.
Uncle Steve has been on the show twice now. You're actually following him up, James. We just had him on for the last episode or before yours. So,
That's great.
but the
Yeah.
fir but the first time he came on the show, I think I asked him, like, what in his opinion is the secret to adapting his work? And because I'm like you, I'm a movie guy first, and I came to the
Right.
books, through the movies. And
Yeah.
I read Cujo in sixth grade because I'd seen the movie, and I'm like, you know what? If I've seen the movie, I know what the book is, and I can read an adult book. And I thought I was gonna, with a lot of these questions, especially craft questions you ask Steve King, you get this, you expect like this incredible deep answer to it, and it's usually his answers are wonderful and honest, and but not like this grand, like, oh my God, you just cracked creativity for me kind of things. He essentially said, I think, the ones that are adapted for my short stories tend to do really well. And he didn't really dive too much into that, but it is something I've thought about, that the adapting a short story leaves you so much room to do your own thing. And the monkey's a prime example of this, where, I think I saw when I saw the movie, Oz did a live stream Q&A, and during the Q&A he said that he's like, pretty much the short story is the premise, and there wasn't much there, so it felt like he felt like he had the freedom to add his own personal, fucked up family, issues that he wanted to work out through the movie, into it. And so yeah, I think there is something there where the short stories, like, are kind of, if you look at them like jokes, they're like the setup and punchline, and then you can just embellish from there. And
Right.
and it seems to work very well for the cinematic medium.
That's really true. I want to speak to that a little bit, and touch on the first portion about how, when you talk to Steven, he's a very normal guy, right? When you chat with him, it's just like it could be anyone. If you don't see him and don't recognize that Stephen King, you just think like, he's a genre fan of some sort. And you're right, he doesn't necessarily get into the deep philosophical reason of why he does what he does. Like sometimes he gives you answers that just seems very much on the surface. And I kind of think that's really cool. Like he doesn't, there's no pretension to him. You know what I mean? I don't know if you guys agree with that or not. Like he just comes across as like it's just a fan. He's like a fan. He loves what he does, and he continues to do it. And he just so happened to be a guy who's so good at what he does, right? And I truly do agree why I do believe why his short stories make for better features than his long form books. His long form books ultimately do better as long form stories, meaning they work best. That's where they work much better in TV format or long form streaming formats that he's been doing. They're just better adaptations, I think, because his world is so rich, full of characters, and you kind of really, like it's really hard to kind of break, like however many hundreds of pages into like a 2-hour movie, whereas His short stories are basically the foundation of what a feature could be. And, you know, as a writer filmmaker, you come in there and you just grow on that
Right.
and you expand on that. And the layout of all they simply laid out. And so that's why I think his short stories make for much better features than his bigger, thicker books.
And the books and the novels that are a little leaner, like Misery, The Dead Zone, Carrie, like, you know,
Right.
they're
Those
almost
can.
those fit the movie format too,
They
but you're
do,
right.
but they end up being longer movies, right? If you look at it, like Misery was a long film. You know,
Well,
all those
yeah,
ones are the
precisely.
longer
Yeah,
formats.
they can, but they also seem to be the ones that are changed the most. Because if you go back and read Carrie, Brian De Palma did a, you know, and he didn't write the movie, but you know, when they adapted the movie, when he directed it, it's, you know, it's told in a completely different way. In the book, it's that epistolary style. It's this interview, not epistolary, I guess that's when you're writing after the fact, but it's like interviewing the people that were there and you piecing together the story. It's a completely different narrative
Well, it's like
structure than the novel.
a found footage novel
Almost,
in a
yeah.
way, right? Like it's like little newspaper clippings.
Which I kind of shit talked in the intro, by the way. But I do like a good found footage movie. I want it on the record that found footage isn't dead to me. But I can tell you that when Saw came out, James, like there was such a sigh of relief because we had only been like getting found footage or kind of watered down PG-13 studio stuff. So I think that, you know, when I talked at the top of it that you've been at the kind of, you know, forefront of different swings in genre. Like I wasn't blowing smoke, man. It's like, you know, you've done it
Thank you.
twice as I can count in your career where it's like the industry was going one way and you're like, nah, this is interesting to me. And you were able to capture audiences and completely swing, you know, everybody was
Right.
following your lead in that. And you did that again with Insidious and The Conjuring, because you couldn't get supernatural horror made for a decade. And then suddenly now that's, you know, that's what, you know,
Yeah.
everybody wanted, so.
I think The Conjuring, the biggest thing we learned from The Conjuring was making a horror movie that got released in the summer period. I don't think you guys remember, but there was a big chunk there where they say you don't put horror films out in the summer period because you just cannot compete with those big tentpole studio films, right? Those
Right.
big $100 million films.
Right.
And I think The Conjuring was the reason, is the reason why in recent times that, you know, studios have been more confident with putting horror films out in the summer period. But if you think back to the 70s, all the big horror films that we grew up with, like Jaws, like The Exorcist or whatever, right, they all pretty much came out during the summer period. And they were treated highly, you know, very, very respectfully in the 70s. And then in the 80s, you know, people started shitting on it. I don't know, maybe because we started making, you know, because technology allow us to make more, you know, sort of like more gore driven, effects driven, and therefore, you know, they were seen, you know, not as highbrow, I guess, and they were sort of kind of talked down to. But you know, we all love the 80s sort of horror films,
Of course.
so for our generation, it meant a lot more than you know, than the critics of that period, and so then horror films really fell off the radar as a summer experiential movie, and I think yeah, it was The Conjuring that kind of like gave people the confidence again to put it back in the summer place.
Nice.
Scary movies are and scary stories are in a perpetual cycle of proving themselves to the
Right.
culture because I think it's because it's such an, you know, you mentioned pretentious that Steve's not pretentious. Well, first of all, he's such a pretentious asshole. I can't say it. So smug. No,
Definitely
but
not
he,
blue collar at all, you know.
yeah, no, but he's a man of the people and he's a storyteller of the people and scary stories once were just stories. They
Yeah.
were, there's something primal about horror that's sitting around a campfire telling stories that are aimed at getting the young ones to not go out and get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or by whatever else
Right.
is out there in the wilderness, living
Yep.
in a cave somewhere, whether it's a human or not. And I think that leads to a certain part of society that will always turn up its nose at horror, or they'll embrace a little bit of it as elevated horror, right? But really, what
Right.
it all comes down to is fear of what you don't understand, what you're grasping to understand, what you're afraid will kill you, what you're afraid will take your loved ones away from you. What lies beyond that we can't see? But these are the big questions. that we ask. And I think they're very deep questions. And horror
Yeah.
is a way of reckoning with those things, just like the monkey is Oz's way of dealing with what happens when horrific, unexpected, almost unthinkable things just fall from the sky into your lap and how you deal with that. And
Yeah,
but
quite
I thought
literally in the film. For people that have seen it, not giving anything away.
Yeah, I
No,
mean,
I agree. I yeah,
people die
no,
in all sorts of
that's
big, crazy ways in this movie.
because
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that Oz tapped into in a big way is that death and violence are so random, right? Like things just comes out of nowhere, and that's really. That's really what I think makes the monkey really interesting, Oz's approach to it, which is, and one of the things he did that I'm really thankful that he didn't go down this path is, how much can I talk about?
This
Is
is
this
coming
coming
out
out
before the
before?
movie comes out, so
Okay, all
I
right,
would
good.
steer away from specific spoilers, but it's also based
Yeah,
on
okay.
a story that I think most listening, you're talking to a Stephen King podcast, so they might,
Yeah.
if it fits within the basic story, you're not going to be in danger of spoiling anybody.
Sure. Okay, good. Good. Well, let's just say that Oz did a thing with the monkey by not diving necessarily too deep into like the mythology origin of the monkey. I think that is what's great about it, is like because not knowing where evil comes from makes it much scarier,
Oh,
right? Because a
yeah.
lot of times you don't know where, if you're like, why does Jason Voorhees just keep coming back to life and killing. Like, what is his reason for doing that? And not explaining it is far more terrifying than trying to explain it.
It
And
makes.
I think a lot of these horror movies that do work are not afraid to. And a lot of times you have to fight the studio's instinct of going, guys, we gotta explain. Like, we have to fill in all the dots so everyone understand what's going on. But I think hold your ground and don't go there. It makes for a better movie.
When I interviewed Oz yesterday for a piece I'm doing in Vanity Fair, and he said that very same thing, is that there was some effort by, I don't know if it was financiers or other producers, maybe you, I don't know, you tell me, but he said somebody was
No,
like
we try not to give Oz dumb notes.
but he said he got the suggestion of can they dig the monkey up in India somewhere, or like that this monkey comes from somewhere, and he said no, he just is. And I thought that's so, that anytime a horror movie starts to explain too much, you want a little bit of understanding, but not, you don't want like the Scooby-Doo pull the mask off, you explain the whole thing, because it removes that terrifying element. When the monkey is just elemental, like a mountain, like how did the mountain get there? It's just there, and you
No,
must
no.
deal with
You
it.
don't want to remove the mystery. The mystery is what makes it captivating. It makes you lean into the movie more, wanting to know more, but then when you don't get it's also okay. Because the movie delivers in every other department, right? Like, it's really fun, it's really entertaining. The kills are freaking outrageous. I've never seen kills like that. I like that Oz kind of describe it a little bit like, like every time he designed a kill, it's like killing Wile E. Coyote in a Roadrunner episode. It's so outrageous, it's so cartoony, but it makes it so much fun. And because of that, you just kind of go along with it, and you just go on this wild ride.
But it
That's what
fits
I
into the
mean.
world, and that's what's in, what I think the secret sauce of this movie is this is the world where, I think that you can see a glimpse of this in, I think, the trailer where the young priest, preacher goes up during the funeral, and people don't understand just how like funny this dude is and how everybody reacts to it or doesn't. Sometimes people react to, there's a shot in the trailer of, the woman running with her baby carriage on fire. It's like this is a world where that can happen and people, it's not gonna like break people's brains. For some reason, this world's a heightened world to begin with, and you set it up. I mean, that's the way the whole thing's set up. You don't need an origin story. You have it with, the bit at the beginning with the
The
father,
opening.
with the father trying to return the monkey that he purchased.
It does set the tone for the rest of the movie. You're right. That opening sort of prologue kind of lets you know what kind of movie you're in for.
Yeah.
Yeah,
It's
that's
funny.
great.
Mystery is a core element to both horror and humor because, again, this I don't think this gives away too much, but he comes in and the guy behind the counter of this shop where he's trying to return the monkey goes, "Well, you have some blood all over your shirt." And he goes, "Yeah, it's not mine. It's this and then he pauses and goes, "You know what? I'll just it's too complicated to explain." And just that is so funny and also so horrific because you're like, it's too long a story. I can't get into how this blood got there, but trust me,
You know,
weird.
we've always said that horror and comedy are literally siblings
Yeah.
in the cinematic world. It's they both function on a primal human level, right? Like when you see something funny or outrageous, you laugh. When you see something funny, see something scary and outrageous, you scream at it, right? And then when you scream at it, then you start laughing at yourself or screaming at it. And so it truly is, you know, like they're siblings, they go hand in hand. And I've always said, even down to the crafting of comedy, like crafting of jokes and crafting of horror set pieces are very similar in that both requires, you know, a setup. So you set up the joke and then you come in with a punchline. In a horror set piece, you set up the scare, you set up the you know, the mystery or the suspense, and then you potentially pay it off with a punchline. And in the case of a punchline for a horror moment, it could be a jump scare, right? So they both have very similar thing, both building up to give you this primal reaction to the moment.
And that's why
And
laughter is the response often in a movie theater when
often, yeah.
everybody's watching a movie after the scare, everybody laughs.
Everybody laughs. Yeah, because you're laughing at yourself or screaming at something on the screen. And so, yeah, they do beautifully go hand in hand.
And when people think that like a jump scare is cheap, it's usually because it's not set up. That's when you get the cliche of the cat jumping out of a closet or something, you know, in the Friday the
So, yeah,
13th.
those are bad jump scares. And I hate it when people sort of like lump, you know, when people say that jump scares are lazy, it's not what's smart, it's not good horror. I'm like, but that's the bad jump scare. Great jump scares are fucking hard to do right. And it takes so much craft to do it. And people who cannot do it, right, or are ashamed, afraid to do it, cannot do it. That's why they talk shit about it.
Yeah, it
I
really
like
is the
that.
secrets in that setup that you were talking about. Like the example that jumped to mind from your work is the clap game in The Conjuring. You know, that is something that is established early on, and then when it comes back into play, it is like one of the most iconic moments of the movie. You know, that's the thing I think a lot of people think about when they think of that movie is that scare. And there's so much more scary shit in that movie than you know, hands coming out of a dark and you know, darkness behind, you know, Lily Taylor and clapping. But you know, people think of that because it's you know, you get that great setup and you know, the release in that moment. So yeah.
Well, and you, if you
James.
think about it, just hand clapping is not supposed to be a scary thing.
No, I mean it's
But the
loud, it's
setup.
sudden. You know, my cats think it's scary when I do it, so
Get
I don't know.
off of the couch. There is that biological theory that laughter evolved as a way for humans in a kind of tribal setting or a group setting to communicate to each other that the danger is lifted, right? And it's this sort of it's the sort of sound that's why a laugh track is comforting, right? And you laugh along with it. It's like, oh yeah, we're this vibration is going through the group and we're aware that we were running, but now we've stopped and we're not going to go off the cliff. We're going to laugh. And
That's
obviously
true.
it's more psychologically complex than that, but that's its roots. And I think you're right. Brother and sister, or brother and brother, or sister and sister. That's what horror and comedy is.
Totally.
I interrupt this chat about the monkey with a great James Wan to tell you more about, well, The Monkey, produced by James Wan. I love this movie, which is filled with the most outrageous, gory deaths and has this perfect, darkly comedic tone. We talk a bit about it with James. I'm not blowing smoke when I talk about how much I love this movie. It's a great audience movie. There's nothing like it out there. It's a real good time at the movies. And I'm not just saying that because they're our sponsor for this episode. Don't tell the ad folks of Fangoria, but I would have gushed about this movie for free. Based on Stephen King's iconic short story, The Monkey has been brought to the screen by Osgood Perkins, the writer-director of Long Legs. Our guest, the horror master James Wan. Stephen King has called the movie batshit insane and said, "You've never seen anything like it." And Bloody Disgusting calls it the most outrageous horror movie of the year. And just a friendly reminder, The Monkey opens in theaters everywhere February 21st. Go see it. All right, that's enough about The Monkey. Now let's get back to talking about The Monkey.
You know, I wanted to ask you about the, you know, not to compare them, but the differences in tone between something like Saw and The Monkey, which both have elaborate kills. They're both about the fear we have of confronting the worst case scenario. You know, they're all variations right. on would you rather, right? That you know, you would rather right. not. But I felt like Saw was such, it's a more sober, serious film. It, not that it doesn't also have laughs, but it's it leans more toward like the terror than The Monkey, which alleviates the terror with humor. Both have a lot of kills, but can you talk about the differences between them in tone and how you set up a trap for someone? Mm-hmm. And in Saw, I think there's a sense of dread, and in the monkey, I think there's a sense of like absurdity to the payoff right. for all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in The Monkey, what makes it comedic is, other than the outrageous set pieces, is that Oz played a lot of these characters, his actors, in a very deadpan way, right? Like, you know, that's what makes it kind of funny. Everyone, like, crazy stuff's happening here, and the characters are like, oh yeah, you know, like that happens, shit happens. whereas obviously the intention for Saw early on was obviously different to what Oz did with The Monkey. You know, with the intention with Saw early on was about trying to make an indie movie that can break out of all the glut of indie films that were around in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. the late 90s, you know, like you're during the boom of the sort of Americana sort of resurgence in movie making, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like the American new wave of movie making that came in the 90s with the likes of your Quentin Tarantino, your Robert Rodriguez, your Kevin Smith, and all those guys, right? So that eventually sort of filtered its way to more indie horror films. Mm-hmm. And so Lee Whannell and I felt that for us to break out, we wanted to do, you know, a high concept horror movie, but one that was somewhat, that was serious, that that was maybe somewhat bleak. But given how bleak, you know, and how much we pushed the outrageousness of it, and again, you know, it's that fine line. If you cross too far past the line of outrageous, it becomes fucking funny, it becomes mm-hmm. hilarious, and it becomes funny in a non-intended way. And so like Saw was always kind of on that fine line of like, sometimes it's so outrageous that it becomes goofily humorous. Mm-hmm. whereas then sometimes we dial it back. Sometimes we're aware of some things that are supposed to be funny. Whereas I guess The Monkey, you know, from the get-go, Oz just knew that he was basically making a black comedy, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Like horrific comedy. And so he really played it that way. He leaned into it in that respect. But yeah, it really is that fine line. You either don't cross that line or you cross that line and embrace the comedy.
Right.
It's also about velocity too, right? Because so much of Saw is about, you set up what the premise is and then the person is like, shit, how do I get out of this? And it's their dread right. of trying to solve the mystery. And in The Monkey, it's like, you don't have time to think. It's like, boom, you've just exploded. Like there's no, there's well, just.
Yeah, I mean, with The Monkey, again, it's about the mystery of like, you don't know who's going to die, right? That's the concept. Mm-hmm. You wind up with toy monkey and then someone dies. Like you can't control it. It just picks someone random in your world
right.
and it kills them. And it's that sort of southern kills that kind of like makes it, I guess, kind of comedic, right?
It's almost like you mentioned Quentin Tarantino. Sorry to interrupt you, but like you mentioned Quentin Tarantino, and it reminds me of Marvin's death.
Oh, yeah, Marvin's death, yeah, in the car, right?
Right?
Yes.
Oh no,
Yeah.
I shot Marvin in the head, like
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Whenever it's so unexpected, it's fucking, you're basically like, holy shit, that just happened. And you cannot help but laugh at it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and
I think.
I think so much of that comes from Oz's sensibility. And I know that there probably could be a dozen variations of adapting this story that would be incredible, but there's something about the secret sauce of bringing him in particular, and I'd love to talk to you
Yes.
about this because Osgood Perkins is a creative weirdo in the best way, right?
He is.
I could easily see his vision for something like this not surviving the typical studio system and the notes process and stuff. So I want to definitely touch on what's it like for you producing a movie like this for someone like Oz.
Oh,
You
it's
know, are
great.
you finding that you're, you know, having to protect him from, you know, or protect his vision more than typical, or is it just like everybody's just signed up and on, you know, just on the Oz train from the beginning? Like,
You know, I mean that's a cool thing about Oz is from the get-go, he is a really cool guy. He's a very knowledgeable guy. He knows what he's doing. And so there's that sense of comfort that if you pass this particular baby IP that we had at Atomic Monster, obviously we love our King projects, and trying to match the different projects to the right filmmakers is very important for us. And when Oz showed interest in it early on, we knew that this could be in the perfectly right hand. And we weren't quite sure early on, like, to what degree he was going to push it. Like, is he going to make it more scary and kind of more bleak, more kind of like somber, like Long Legs, right? Or more or really lean into the outrageousness, which he eventually did. But we knew from the get-go that it was in the right hand, and that whatever we do, we wanted to support his vision for this. And having Neon on board as well, who I think put out Long Legs for him,
Yeah,
right?
they did.
And so they had a great relationship with Oz. They trust him, and Oz really loved them as well. And so we just let him make the movie he wanted ultimately.
He told me one of the challenges was that the monkey is not an active participant. The monkey is not Chucky. He doesn't come to life and kill you.
Oh yeah. Believe me, I was saying to Oz, I know exactly what you had to go through to make an inanimate object come to life. And for us to be fearful of this thing that just sits there and really doesn't do anything. I mean, I guess it bangs the drums, but you have to build in so much ominous fear and tension around this inanimate object. It's like shooting Annabelle. That's again, that's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Oh yeah, exactly. But it's the same vibe, right? It's this thing. It's not, you can't drop kick your way out of it, right? Like it's go, when it starts banging that drum, you don't know what direction the dread or the danger is going to come from. It's not stoppable, it's not quantifiable, and that's where the fear comes from. But it is but did you compare notes about Annabelle and the monkey, the inanimate doll?
I didn't compare it in a post-mortem way. Not so much early on. I would have loved to talk to him a bit more early on, but he did a great job. He actually said, I said, was it hard to, like, from a filmmaking standpoint, how do you shoot it? How do you make it creepy, right? This thing that just sits there. And he goes, he says he didn't have to do anything because on day one, when the monkey showed up, he was like, ugh. Like, this thing is creepy. This thing is like yucky and pretty terrifying as well. And so he said, when you have, and I totally agree, when you have the right sort of, like, I guess, icon, this thing, whatever it is, and if it already from the get-go, it induces a lot of creep, a lot of sort of just a lot of yuckiness about it, then like half your job is done. You just got to know where to put the camera and how to photograph it and put the light on, correct lighting on it, and it will take care of the rest.
He
So
told me
even the
that
right path goes a long way.
he told me one of the child actors that was on set got a look at the prop and said, "I hate that." And he goes, "That's the response. Not I'm a favorite or that's weird." It wasn't like a judgment on it. It was just like, "I am alarmed to be in this thing's presence." And that's when he was like, "Yes, that's the right response. Good on you, kid."
That is when you know it works, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's an effective horror image, and those things are fucking creepy. I mean, the symbol monkeys. I
Yeah.
know this isn't a symbol monkey; it's a drum monkey. You know, we're gonna have to call it a different name. But, you know, but those things are creepy as fuck. Like, those that came like out of an era where they were everything that was a child's toy was like just pure nightmare fuel. Like, I don't know what the
Yeah.
hell was up with like the early 1900s or whatever.
Who
Here, but
made
like
that
every
thing?
doll looks like it's, you know, it comes pre-haunted, you know. It's like every like it, there's something about the child's toys of that era, and there's a reason why, you know, you held up the book earlier, Anthony. It's like there's a reason why King and his publishers use that as a, you know, as the
Yeah.
cover of the short story collection.
My grandfather had one of those symbol monkeys, and well before I'd ever heard of this story or saw this cover of the book, that thing was terrifying because it not only clashes its symbols, but it grimaces and it makes a
It makes
noise and
the
it's
sound like, hey, yeah, like
yeah,
really
it
creepy. Yeah.
screeches and its mouth spreads, its lips go up and down, so it just grimaces at you. And it has, you know, one of the things I love in King's short story is he describes the monkey and he describes the eyes, like the stupid evil eyes, like just this sort of dumb rage. And I'm like, Oz, you really captured it with that design. Like it does, it just sort of is like a madness personified in a toy. I gotta wonder who made this thing.
Yeah,
They
I want to know the origin of that as well. I mean, the symbol monkey is even creepy in the Toy Story
All
episode.
right.
One of the Toy Story, yeah, I don't know, I can't remember which one it was, but it was freaky when the monkey starts clapping like this. You're like, holy crap.
Isn't that
Rez,
the
was it
reason
your
you can't
story where that came out,
where they were talking about you couldn't you actually use the symbols because Toy Story had trademarked it?
Because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, because I think Disney bought the rights to that toy. And so we had to change the monkey. I actually had a similar kind of toy monkey as well in the first Conjuring, just as a haunted prop icon, just sitting in the Warren's shelf in the haunted museum. And we had to change it. We had to make that monkey I had. We had to change. He was playing an accordion, and I had to put glasses on him, and he was wearing a hat. So you have to change it
You had to
enough so that you don't
Clark
get in
Kent up your
trouble.
creepy monkey to
Yes.
as long as there's glasses on it, he's not Superman.
I'd like to see the
Yeah,
court case though.
exactly.
Like Disney brings the court case and it actually goes to trial, and sitting there, like beside one of the attorneys, is a little monkey in a vest with symbols, like,
I hope
Well,
not.
you since you touched on this, we can't let it pass. I think one of the coolest things about the Conjuring movies is that it's something that happens with the monkey. It's like I love movies and especially genre stories where it picks up and there's already a built-in back history of all the shit that's been going down, right? You're coming in medias res. And one of the things I love about that Warren's room in The Conjuring is that there's a story to every one of those things. How in God's name is there not an HBO Max series that is just following like the story behind every single one of, you know, those haunted objects? I know that Dauberman touched on that in his Annabelle movie, which I really loved,
Yeah.
by the way.
You know, Eric,
But
we've actually pitched this. I pitched this
yeah.
many times, many years back, saying you need to be a series that is just based on a haunted item. Every episode, right? Every like a TV series, every episode is one particular haunted item. And at the start of that episode, you will either have Vera Farmiga or Patrick Wilson doing their little sort of Hitchcockian intro, right? The intro go, this little item we found in so and so, and here's its story. And then you go into the story of the monkey, or of the evil dagger, ritualistic dagger, or the samurai suit, whatever, right? But yes, I totally agree with you. They should be a series.
I
Well,
love it. I would watch that. It's like
do you
Night
guys
Gallery.
remember in the was it the 80s or early 90s? There was the Friday the 13th TV
Exactly.
series.
It was
That's
exactly
what it would
that
be.
premise. Yeah. I
Yeah,
mean, and
that's what
listen,
it
that's
should
not a
be.
good, you know, you don't want to bring that up in pitch meetings because nobody re really remembers that fondly. But it's not
But it was
because
a
it's a
great
bad
show. I
idea.
love that show. It
It's
was so
a good
cool.
show. It's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
It's just that it was called Friday the 13th and everybody wanted a Jason Voorhees show, and that's not what that
That's the
was. So,
problem. Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
so
More
you don't
like
have
Tales
that
from the
problem.
Dark Side.
You don't have that problem with doing a Conjuring universe show. I'm just saying, you know, maybe, you know, the weird horror is having a moment right now and just say like, listen, it's time to dust that off and bring that to TV.
James, do you
Yep.
feel that there's a Can you talk about the connection to Stephen King's own sense of humor? I presume you've seen Maximum Overdrive. I know that's one of Eric's favorites.
Yeah, I love that movie.
And when I was talking to Oz, Maximum Overdrive came up, and I said the deaths at the end of the world at the beginning of that movie plays a lot like The Monkey is. Steve has this crazy sense of humor. He has this sort of dark Tales from the Crypt, EC Comics, Creepshow sense of humor, where he loves to genuinely terrify you, but he also loves to just sort of play and kid around. You know, in Maximum Overdrive, you have all these deaths, and then a steamroller, like it kind of Dukes of Hazzards into a baseball field and rolls over all little league team, which is not how a steamroller works,
My
but.
favorite moment is when the kid goes to the vending machine to get a drink and another soda can just
Yeah, it's firing soda cans out of
firing
there.
and killing, like, shooting the kids. Yeah, I love Maximum Overdrive. It was one of my favorite movies growing up as a kid, and I think I don't know if like Steven loves it as much as we all do.
Yeah.
I own a 35mm print of Maximum
Oh
Overdrive, so,
wow,
and it's
that's
a gorgeous
incredible.
print. We brought it up when King was on the show, and he was just like, do you, he didn't say it exactly like this, but the tone was like, do you really? You know, it was like,
But
it's like, yeah, I
often
love
when
it.
he gets critically beat up, it's because he's being funny and not that serious. And he told me in an interview once that, that's the reason he thinks Needful Things got trashed by critics, but readers love it because they get that it's meant to be funny. It's meant to be absurd that these small town folk are tearing each other apart over these petty differences that don't matter. It's ridiculous, but it means a lot to them. And I think the same thing is true in The Monkey. It's these deaths are so absurd that that's the point, is it it all sometimes has an absurd quality to it, but I think you've captured his humor with this movie.
I do think, yeah, coming back to like how similar horror and comedy are, I think he walks that fine line, and sometimes like his set pieces or his concept, his overall story just leans into that world, and he embraces it. He's not afraid for to lean into like the more crazy, outrageous humor. People either get it and laugh along with it, or people don't and they shit on it, right? But the smart people get
That's what I liked
it.
about Gary Dauberman's Salem's Lot is while I was watching it for the first time, again, there's a number of ways you could adapt that story. You can make it a very straightforward, serious Salem's Lot, like the original 1979 miniseries, which I love. But I also like Gary's take where it's like, oh no, we're going to make this a Saturday night Grindhouse movie and lean into the 70s exploitation of it and have these sort of crazy set pieces. And I thought that movie had a lot of humor in it too. And obviously you were a producer on that and worked with him.
Yeah, no, I mean, I want to speak to that. Gary Dauberman is such a he has so much respect for Stephen King, and he loves Stephen in a lot of
He's
ways.
a
I mean,
Mainer, right? He lives in Maine
he's
too,
from
yeah.
that part of the world, and so like he idolizes the guy, and and it was a big get for him when he got around to write to adapt it, right, for Warner Brothers New Line. And so no, he loves Stephen King, and so when it was his chance to kind of play with Salem's Lot as director, he was very sort of thoughtful of that. He actually did a lot. He was very faithful to the book, in a big way. And so the tricky thing about being so faithful to a book that came out back then is, if you look at it now, so much of the tropes that Stephen started back in the day, so much that he kind of leaned into that were cool and fresh, have been kind of done to death by today's standard, right? And like the crucifix, the stake, and the heart, and all that stuff. And so, because Gary was so, enamored to that world, and he was very true and faithful to that world, I think that was a big part of the reason why, like today's audience, when they look at it, they kind of go, oh, we've seen all this before. And so that was that was the biggest challenge we had with Salem's Lot in our very first early cut. It's like, oh, it's like, how do we now try and make it a little bit more different?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, it was revolutionary whenever Stephen King set vampires out of castles and, you know, out of Eastern Europe and all this stuff, and into small town
Suburbs, South
America. And
Americana,
now that's pretty much the norm. And again, it's because that, you know, people like Stephen King, Steven Spielberg did the same thing, bringing ghosts in the suburbs and shit. It's like, you know, that's the, you know, that is now like the default setting, because pretty much everybody that's telling stories now are we're all weaned on Steven Spielberg and Stephen King. So yeah, it
two
is. It's
Stevens,
tricky. The
yeah,
two Stevens.
but
I mean,
it.
I interviewed the Duffers, and you know, obviously you two gentlemen very inspired by both. And they, you know, the interview was ended up just being about my two dads and my 80s Stevens dads. You know, it's like that's, you know, that's for people who grew up in that era. That's who we watched. You know, it's like that's
You know,
where
but that's right.
I came from.
Tommyknockers has a lot of that humor too. It's one of the things I really love about that book is it's you know, these small town folk develop these powers and are able to harness this alien technology, but the raw materials they use are everyday items. Like, I love the hovering Coke machine that is sort of a sentry guard to keep people out of the town. And I remember, I think, hopefully this isn't a story told out of school, but I think I remember talking to Jeremy Slater about that. And he goes, yeah, that's one of the things in the room that executives are like, no, we're not doing that. That's ridiculous. But like, that's what's fun about it.
Yeah, I mean, it is tricky. It's funny because there is, again, a fine line of why, you know, and again, you know, testament to Mr. King for realizing that when he writes for books, it's a different medium. And when you're adapting it for a movie or a TV series or whatever, it's a different medium again. And that's what is kind of cool about him is he lets his filmmakers make the movies that they want, you know, like makes them however they want to interpret his stories, right? Because he understand, and having been a director himself, he gets how hard it is to make movies. But he understands that, yeah, you know, like writing books is one way, making movie is another way. And so, like, you know, and so he's actually really cool in how he's not precious about it, and he lets the filmmakers kind of like interpret his work, and I really admire that. And yes, certain things that could read really cool in a book might not look as good when you see it, you know, visually. Sometimes, you know, like it's less silly when you put your brain to the imagination, but when you see it, it might be a little bit hokey. And I think Stephen understands these things.
I
Now
know
you.
Eric said we wouldn't hold your feet to the fire too much about it, but can you share anything about the development of Tommyknockers? What would have been the coolest thing in your mind if that had come to
You
fruition?
know, I mean, that was one of the great things about getting Jeremy. I'm such a big fan of Jeremy. Jeremy also wrote Mortal Kombat 2 for us, and the guy is just such a brilliant writer. You know, he's such a great smart filmmaker. I would love to, you know, I think he has a director's brain, so hopefully one day, you know, he'll get around to direct something really cool himself.
I've heard some of his ideas for the stuff he wants to make as a director, and like I'm with you. That like I play video games with that dude almost every night. So and believe it or not, he's very tight-lipped on a lot of this stuff though. I remember when he said right before it broke that he was doing the Tommyknockers, and knowing I was a big Stephen King fan, and I'm just like, I think he said when he got into the industry, he wanted to do something with Spider-Man, and he wanted to do a Stephen King thing. Like he's like, those are my, if I check those off, you know, if I do that in Star Wars or something, you know, it was like one of those things.
Those
It
are
was
his
in that,
bucket list,
it was
a
the
very
bucket list
bucket list.
thing. And I remember telling him at the time, I'm like, dude, that is, you are taking on quite a challenge, because I'm not as fond of the Tommyknockers, the book, as Anthony is here. But that also, I think what I told him then, I'm like, but that what's great about that is neither is Stephen King. You know, King talks shit about that book all the time. And it's like, but what I told him then, it's like, you have an opportunity here to, you know, to do something kind of like what Jon Favreau did with Iron Man, who wasn't a beloved character at the time. It's like, it's not like you guys are remaking The Shining. It's like you have the opportunity to, you know, forge a new path and to make something, honestly, that's, you know, better than the book, in my opinion. And I know he was excited about that. He hasn't, again, he's tight-lipped about his actual work stuff, but so he's never let me read the script or anything, but But I don't know.
It's
I'm
good.
talking a lot when everybody wants to hear you talk about working on the Tommyknockers, so.
Yeah,
I think Jeremy should secretly share with you guys, and then you guys can then get on your podcast and tell everyone how great the script is.
Okay.
And therefore, the studio would have to step up to it and make it.
Can you share one? Can you share one cool thing, like one thing about that whole premise that you think would have been awesome to see?
Well, I think, I don't necessarily have one thing in particular, but what I will say that he did really great is, taking the King concept of this town discovering this thing and kind of digging around and going, oh my God, it's a freaking spaceship, right? I always love that. And so I love kind of what Jeremy did with that, how he kind of parceled it out with the different characters and stuff like that. It always reminded me of one of the Quatermass story, one of the
Right.
Quatermass experiment, what I think might be the second one, where they discover, they're digging in the subway of London, and they're trying to expand this railway subway track, and they end up finding a spaceship that is stuck underground, and that's what I really love about Jeremy's sort of setup for this as well, taking what King had and running with it. So I like it more in that umbrella overall thought.
As we're closing out this chat, you've produced a lot of Stephen King stuff. When are you going to direct one? Is there a story that you would love to sink your teeth in? Is there a particular thing that you? I mean, you, for all I know, you've already got something in the works. You're like, shut the fuck up, dude. You're going to ruin this for me. I can't talk about this right now. But
I guess I
is
can speak because I don't necessarily have anything in the pipe myself, but I have three of his stories that I love. Two of which have already been made. I'm obviously my love for Creepy Clown. I love it. It was probably one of my favorites, and story wise and the world and all that. And obviously it's already been made, and so that one's kind of I would have loved to have seen what my version of it would have been. I think it could have been. I don't know. I think it could have been cool as well. And then Salem's Lot was something that, even though I ultimately produced, that was one that I had an eye for directing early on. So that's why, we got onto we got the project, we got the IP, and I was initially developing that for myself until I got busy and getting stuck on the Aquaman films, and I ultimately could not do it.
Wait, Jason Momoa killed your dream of directing Salem's Lot? Is this what I'm hearing? All right.
Those movies are so big. Those movies are so big to make
Right.
and so long. So it ate up
It's
like the
true,
last
yeah.
5, 6 years of my life.
Right.
So I didn't get around to so eventually it found its way to Gary. And I think the only one maybe left for me that I would love to take on just because I know what an epic movie this could be is The Stand. I love The Stand.
That's interesting. Would you think of it as a TV project, or would you think of it as a film?
Well,
Because I
that's
know
the
like
thing, right? Yeah, because it's the again the book is so big. I feel like like a longer platform would be the right place for The Stand. Or if you do a feature movie of The Stand, it's going to be a very long movie. It's going to be like over 3 hours long, and maybe there's part one and part two. So ultimately,
That to me, I think, is
it's
the secret
out.
sauce. When Ben Affleck was gonna direct it, I think that was his plan, was to make two movies.
Two movies, yeah.
And I'm like, I think that's actually the way to do it. Look, I mean, look at
Yeah.
how well that worked for it. You know,
Right,
you can
right.
take these longer things, you
Or
can
three
let them
movies.
breathe, and you can give them a big budget of,
Right.
actually, 'cause something like The Stand, you have to do big. You can't do the budget version of The Stand
No.
and you're gonna miss, you're gonna miss the stuff that makes the story appealing, the wandering, the dead America, and
Yeah.
seeing what that is, and
Yes.
meeting the 18,000 fucking characters that he wrote in there, and
Right.
all of them are fascinating, and you don't want to cut any of them, so it's like
Yeah.
I think that could do well. I will recommend, if you are like, if you got a Stephen King itch, and like The Stand was just done and on TV, you don't want to do that right now. I would recommend a short story from his latest collection. I don't know if you've read it yet, but it's called The Dreamers.
No, I've not yet. No.
I would pick that up. This is like
Okay.
him working in revival mode. I don't know if you've read Revival. That's one of our favorite books of his here. But it's a little bit in
Oh,
that
cool.
kind of what happens after death. And it's like it's an experiment of piercing the veil to find out what happens, and you don't like what you find in that one. It's a really creepy story.
Is it kind of in the spirit of Flatliners kind of thing?
It's maybe in the neighborhood. I wouldn't, you know,
Okay.
this one. I'll say just read it. It follows like a Vietnam vet who finds out he's really good at transcribing things, and he's kind of brought into, you know, so he's kind of like this guy who's not like a super great fighter or anything, and it's not about him punching, you know, demons or ghosts or anything, but he's like he ends up being the Igor to this other guy that's like running these experiments about thinking he can use dreams and people dreaming to push the boundary and split the veil between this reality and the next. And
That's cool. Okay, I gotta read it now. I gotta check.
I would highly recommend reading it. The other story I would have recommended, I think, just got picked up, and it was called Danny Coughlin's Bad Dream. So that one I think is already spoken for, but that one's a really good one too. Those were like two of the standout ones from the recent
That's
You
cool.
Like It Darker. So check it out,
I will. I
and if you
will.
get it, I want a special thanks in the
You
credits
definitely will get it. You get a
and a
repeat.
set visit.
Yes, for sure.
But yeah, I think that's about all the time we have with you. So is there anything else you want to bring up, Anthony, before we let James go here?
I think just the last thing is, as one of the producers of The Monkey, I think I heard an interesting story about it made you guys on your end a little nervous, but that there was the strike was interfering with the production at one point, or it was almost set to go, and then the strike hit, but Steve held off and said, you know, I just can't sign this deal right now. And I wondered if you could share anything about that story.
You know what? I don't actually know too much about this, I gotta be honest. But yeah, the strike did affect a lot of our projects, you know, like it kind of like prevented us from doing certain things, and prevented us from pushing stuff forward. But then once the strike finished, you know, things just kind of exploded back out again, right? So yeah,
Well,
no,
since
it's
that's a Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, it's been a pretty turbulent year for our industry in the last couple of years, you know, from the pandemic and then the strike. It's just like, yeah, it's been tough. It hasn't been easy, as I'm sure you guys been hearing and seeing as well.
And then half your city burned down. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
Oh my
been
God.
a
Yes.
rough
Yeah,
go.
it's been a tough start to the year.
But in positive news, we all have something fun to go look at in the theater, February 21st. I am so excited for people to see this movie. It is such a great audience movie. It's the kind of thing we've talked a lot about, horror and comedy being kind of sister genres, and both are, you know, are great things to see with a packed crowd that's super into it. Like you know, you're gonna get the chocolate and the peanut butter with the monkey, I guess is what I'm saying here. So
That's
James,
right.
thank you so much
Bye.
for coming on and
Thanks,
chatting with
James.
us.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Appreciate it. Appreciate Anthony, Eric. Good to see you guys. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
Many thanks to James Wan for coming on the show, finally. He's been one of our most requested guests since we started the show, actually back in 2020. You know, James Wan's always been at the top of horror pretty much in most of my adult life. So it makes sense that you listeners wanted him on. And also having talked with him now at length, of course, he's a great chat. He knows his stuff. He's super fun. And I really enjoyed that. And the next episode will drop in a couple of weeks, I believe on the 26th of February, if I'm not mistaken. And if everything goes to plan, we will have one more guest associated with the monkey on to chat about that experience and their favorite King stuff. So fingers crossed everything works out. In the meantime, you can check out the show's Patreon, which is patreon.com/thekingcast, where you'll get extra bonus episodes that you can find only there. If you're new to the show, you'll have over 4 years of bonus episodes with super fun guests to peruse through. It's the best way to support the show. So if you dig what we're doing, throw us a few bucks and we'll make it worth your while. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. And that should be that. Adios, folks. The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late great Scott Wampler.